Welcome back to our series In Conversation With. We're exploring the lives and careers of people across Elgium to understand more about what brought them to asset management. This podcast is intended for investment professionals. Welcome back to Elgium Talks. I'm your host, Mark Chappell, and this is our series In Conversation With. Today, my guest is Head of Retail EMEA, Honor Solomon. Honor, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, Head of Retail EMEA, that sounds like a very big title covering a lot of different areas. What would be your tweet-sized explanation of your role?
So what I'm responsible for is all the intermediaries within Europe and the UK, and actually we've got a distribution agreement in South America as well. So those intermediaries, I think, if I think of the spectrum, it's everything from a private bank, fund of funds, stockbrokers, platforms, and also IFA, so independent financial advisors.
Really kind of a large swathe of the wholesale market as a way of describing that. And to delve into your work history, and perhaps to take it right back, you joined Elgium in 2014 from BlackRock, where you worked for nearly 15 years, a really well-established in BlackRock, and across London, Paris, New York. But I'd like to really go back to the beginning. I know you studied business administration with French at the University of Wales, which is a fascinating degree, to be able to marry up such interesting disparate areas. Did you always want to go into finance from business administration? Where does the love of asset management, say, start?
Well, I wouldn't say that at 2-3 years old when I was playing with my dolls that they were, you know, they were accountants or bankers.
Absolutely.
Or
it's
into
the childhood
insurance.
Dream right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, no, it
right?
definitely wasn't from there. So my background, my father had a clothes shop. He would sell a jacket for £10, a scarf for £2. And from about 2 years old, I was in the back of that shop while my parents were out selling at the front. And then from 3, 4, 5 years old, I was with customers.
Amazing.
So I would say that sales has always been in my blood.
Yeah.
Meeting people and making sure that clients, customers, whether they're buying a scarf or whatever it might be, has always been something that I've enjoyed and has been integral to me.
And I imagine you just get to meet so many different types of people, just people from cultures, backgrounds. I imagine it's certainly a clothes shop in London is meet varied people, right?
Absolutely. So it was in London, in central London. It was 95% of the customers were tourists. Mm. And so I found nothing more fascinating than asking them about their country, where they came from, why they were in London, and just learning a bit more about their backgrounds. So it was great.
Incredible. So that's really kind of instilled a love of meeting people and really kind of, as you say, meeting clients' needs, which is such a integral part of like a sales career. To take this back to finance, you come out of university perhaps with internships. So am I right in thinking? Why finance? Why internships in finance over anywhere else?
So I would say that, like back to my 2-3 years old, but also at 10, 12, 15 years old, I wasn't 100% clear on what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And so the way I thought about it was my degree gave me a pretty broad grounding in business. Mm-hmm. And so the way I went about it was just writing as many applications, for as many graduate schemes. Yeah. I wrote, I think it was 52 applications.
So many different cover letters about why your company speaks to me on a personal level.
Well, that was exactly it. And I would sort of copy and paste the answers.
What bits can you copy? What bits can apply elsewhere?
And and that's, I suppose, advice I give to graduates now, that sometimes it's a bit more of a numbers game. Mm. Make sure you're not ever applying for something that's completely out of your capability. Yes. But for me, it was definitely applying for a lot. And then I got shortlisted for a number of them. And Merrill Lynch was in Paris, and my French wasn't perfect at that point, so it was a way to sort of take that to the next level. And then a route in finance, they gave a fantastic graduate scheme where I knew I was going to learn a lot of different skills, and so it was a great decision that I didn't know was going to be a great decision at that
age. Exactly. I mean, considering that's where you've stayed for your working career, it's incredible that out of the gate, this has allowed you to explore so many different areas of finance and so many different places. I mean, absolutely, as you say, you started in Paris, but am I right in thinking the graduate scheme and the subsequent roles took you to New York as well as elsewhere?
Absolutely. So I was offered, after the internship in Paris, I was offered a role on the grad scheme in London, but their training program was in New York. So I spent a couple of months in New York. Merrill Lynch Financial Center was actually just right next door to the World Trade Center.
Wow.
So the summer of 2001, up until September the 5th, I was in New York.
You were in New York by the World Trade Center.
Right next to the World Trade Center. We would go upstairs in the World Trade Center. We would have drinks there. And then we came back to London to start the more formal part of the training. And my first proper day in the London office was September 11th, 2001. And I remember the graduate scheme, so there were sort of 22 of us. We were being shown around the trading floor, and then suddenly the traders started losing contact with their contacts in New York. And there were screens up everywhere, and at the time people just thought it was a small private plane that had gone in to the World Trade Center. And they ushered us all out into another room, all the grads, and then from that they put it on a big screen. And I remember just not really understanding what was going on, not really understanding the gravity. And one of the girls on the scheme, she was screaming and screaming. And I remember thinking, God, you know, she's being so dramatic. But actually, she had got it right. She had understood the absolute, how the world was going to change from that
day. The
world
was never the same again, really.
No, and half of my team that I subsequently joined were based in New York. And it was a really amazing learning experience because, as well as learning about all the technical work on the grad scheme, so much of it for those first 6 months was about the emotional side, that half of my team had seen people jumping out of windows and the most awful of situations.
Incredible.
And they were all obviously emotionally awful. Yeah. And so it was a terrible but very interesting learning experience to join the city.
It's incredibly emotionally powerful. I mean, it's psychologically distressing for so many people. But as you say, it really brings home how much the personal and the professional can intertwine at moments of sheer peril.
Absolutely. So it was definitely a turning point in my life.
Completely. And so you stayed with Merrill Lynch, which then obviously became BlackRock as it was, working as equity sales, institutional sales to local authority and corporate pension funds, really kind of darting around many different kind of areas of asset management. What made retail your focus?
So I would say for me, I've always, in every career move, I've looked for teams that have a great culture and have got talent within them. So with culture, I always think to myself, I spend more time with my people at work than I do with my husband and my family.
Exactly, nine, 10 hours a day.
And similarly with the talent, I want to be always surrounded by people that I can learn from, by people that are better than me. So I would say that it wasn't that I was so dead set on moving to a retail business from institutional, so whatever, intermediary clients from defined benefit schemes. For me, it was that I found a team where I felt that I could contribute, but more importantly, and probably selfishly, that I could grow and become an even better version of myself.
Exactly. You're using, you know, more talented people than you to show you, here are areas that I can really improve, to go from good to great, as it were.
Absolutely.
And so to perhaps wrap up on where your role currently sits, you're also the CEO and director on both the Unit Trust and Corporate Directors Board of the funds here at Legal & General Investment Management. And I imagine your position so close to clients as head of retail and your experience at these places really allows you to bring a customer-centric view to this sort of position and ensure that the customer is really being represented in the running of the funds. How can you apply these principles on these boards?
Sure. So for me, it's about, in both roles, I would say it's about having the client at the heart of everything we do, which is a very big and bold statement.
Exactly.
But for me, it's about breaking that down into how can we apply what the client needs to our strategy, into what the client needs in terms of operations, so how we onboard the trades, on how we build a technology strategy, on how we make sure that our talent program is making sure that we've got the best people speaking to clients. So I would say in the CEO function, in the CF3 function, I'm able to apply that with more of a regulatory lens, as well as a more of a, as well as a strategic lens.
I think that's such an important point, that regulation has been one of the major trends that we've seen shaping our industry, certainly the retail industry, going forward. How have you seen that play out for clients and even ourselves?
Sure. So I would say, so my favourite thing to do is to be on the road meeting clients. And I would say my number one question that my team would talk about is, I like to say, what keeps you up at night?
Yeah.
Where is your pain? Because those are the sorts of things that I think we should be addressing as a priority, as well as, you know, working on an investment solution for them. It's really making sure that we understand where they're hurting. And I would say the principal change, the principal evolution that I've seen has been how regulation has really grown over the last 10, 15 years. And so it's about helping them to understand. It's about helping us to go on the journey with them. But I should say at the same time, as regulation has increased, I don't see it as a bad thing.
No.
I mean, I see it as a bad thing sometimes because people aren't able to focus perhaps on, you know, the minutiae of investments that I find particularly interesting. But it's all, you know, and into my CEO role, it's all providing additional protection for the customers and for our clients, which, you know, can only be a good thing.
Yeah. The intention behind so many of these regulations are so good, and it's only for the good that, you know, you want to protect clients from unsafe products or products that just aren't suitable for those customers.
Yeah.
The other kind of major trend that we've also seen, which I'd love to touch on, is fee compression on all sides, and the move towards lower fees. And how have you seen that kind of play through your conversations with clients?
Yeah, so without a doubt, the fees are coming down. I mean, I would say, which has absolutely played to LGIM's strength, there's been a much greater move towards index investing. There's been a much greater move to multi-asset investment.
Yep.
And that's all playing to, you know, the fee, the competition that we're seeing in the market to be a provider of value goods. So we're not saying it's about being cheap. We're saying it's about providing a service that is all-encompassing but also provides great value to our clients.
Incredible. And I think that's definitely a trend that we're all seeing. What are the trends that no one's seeing? What's perhaps what people aren't talking about quite so much?
So we talk about this a lot as a team. For me, the ones that I think about personally is I think about disruptors to the market.
In what way? Disruptors to companies we're invested in or disruptors to the investment industry itself?
So it's both, because the two of them are intertwined. So I think a lot about the strategy for the team, you know, for the coming weeks, then for the year, then for the medium term, which is 3 or 4 years. But then what's going to happen in 5 years? What's going to happen in 10 years? So I think about, you know, I watch my children, and they, when I was younger, I would be watching television. I would be watching advertising through an advert on TV, through the weather, which is how LNG really built up its profile. I would look at magazines and newspapers, and she's not doing any of that. She's on YouTube. She's on Snapchat. And so I think to myself, well, when she becomes an investor, or even the teenagers, when they become investors, there's going to be a completely different way to get through to them. And so I suppose what I'm always planning for and thinking about is, what is that way? So, you know, what I would hate is for us to be the blockbuster who misses out on the Netflix. I want us to be the LGIM who is the Netflix of the future,
offering those kind of solutions just on demand, as it were, to take that example.
Yeah, so I think about Amazon, I think about Facebook, and, you know, is there going to be channels through those forums? But then is Amazon and Facebook going to be the channel of the future? So I look a lot at some of the Chinese companies, so say, for example, WeChat, and the ways that they're reaching their customers.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested in some of the Chinese ways of doing it.
Incredible. And so I suppose that's a major trend that perhaps poses a risk to be managed and one to be taken advantage of in that way. What are the changes to the industry that you're most looking forward to, as it were? What's really exciting you 7 years down the line?
It's actually those changes. I mean, the conversations I find most useful are how we're going to evolve, how we're going to adapt to it. But it's also more the blue sky thinking. Mm-hmm. So it's, for me, the art of the possible. So really making sure that we've got the whole spectrum covered of what could happen. Mm-hmm. And more interestingly, what definitely won't happen, because that's probably what will happen.
Yeah. what people are writing off now, actually.
Absolutely.
That's a really interesting note to end that part of the conversation on, about trends for the future. I'd like to turn now to your public work and commitment to the issues of diversity and inclusion, one I know you've spoken a lot about. You helped set up the Legal and General Inclusion team with the wonderful acronym LEGIT. What's behind that drive to set up such a company-wide initiative where there was none before?
Sure. So spent a lot of time thinking about it first.
Yeah.
And because we have had inclusion teams at LGIM, and I was thinking a lot about what worked and what didn't work as well. And for me, it was very much about finding passion across the organisation. So finding people who were passionate about certain causes that would drive this forward, rather than me tapping on the shoulder of a number of people and saying, oh, can you lead this on gender? Can you lead this on physical health or whatever it is? So it was about finding the passionate people and really talking about where they felt that they could make a difference. And when I think about making a difference, inclusion for me is about not just being an LGIM employee, because when I introduce myself at a party, I say I work for LGIM.
It might be a few blank looks.
Well, exactly. But it's about who I really am as a person. And that's what makes people identify with each other and with an organisation. So it's, for me, about tapping in to those characteristics. So obviously a lot has been said about gender, and gender is definitely a compartment of what we're trying to do, but it's just one compartment. So for me, in my team, for example, one of the prompts was that I had a number of people who had lost parents in the past year. So for me, a lot of it is about elderly care, because the people in my team who'd lost parents were now responsible for their remaining parents. And that was taking up a lot of time, and how we were going to support them with that, but also sometimes with what's called the care sandwich, where they are caught between caring for elderly parents and for their children. And so we provide support on that. We have mental health issues. We have physical health issues. We have people who are on the neurodiverse spectrum and how we support them so that they're in roles where actually their neurodiversity, if they're autistic or they're Asperger's or whatever it might be, can be an absolute advantage to their role. We've got BAME, so Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic. We have a work stream that's talking about socioeconomic, so how we can bring people from underprivileged backgrounds into the city and give them the tools so that they can be a success. But on top of that, what they're giving to us is more diversity of thought in our team. So it's not one type of person from one type of background feeding in. It's that range, which is just going to enrich the conversation.
Completely. I'd love to understand a bit more what you mean about the different kind of identities. You're really kind of, if I've understood this right, it's about helping people to be the best versions of themselves, as it were, and allowing them to bring their full personalities, that all their multifaceted identities as a parent, as a child, as it were, to work, which they spend so much of their time, as you mentioned.
Yeah. But it's also, even more simplistic than that. I want everyone in my team, in the organisation, to feel, firstly, that they belong, and secondly, also, that they feel that they've got support around them from people that truly understand them. And the people that are going to truly understand you are going to be the people that are like yourself. So if you're struggling, for example, as we were talking about, with the care of an elderly parent, you're more likely to be able to talk to really discuss your challenges with someone who's in exactly the same position with you, rather than me, who at this point, fortunately, my parents are in a position where their health is in a good position. So I really want to give people that opportunity to speak to people who are similar to themselves,
creating communities, as it were.
Exactly.
On this last point, I'd love to touch on, and I know you do quite a bit of mentoring, which is a part of this in the helping people be their best versions, but really on an individual basis. So how do you approach that in a different way, perhaps from the Legal and General Inclusion team?
So I'm quite military about my mentoring. So I've been mentored, mm-hmm. and I have done mentoring in different ways, and I've had amazing mentors, and the ones that have been really amazing with me have been the ones who've been pretty structured about it, on what do we want to achieve, how do we want to get there, and taking me really on the journey. So I've taken that part of this and been military in the way that I only take on a restricted number of mentees. So I take on 4 a year, okay. and that 4 a year, it's very strict that it's got a beginning and an end in terms of timeline. And we go through what we want to achieve in that year. And we work out essentially an action plan. I ask them to be very prepared when they come to, gosh, it sounds awful. I'm very, very military on this. Ask them to come prepared with the meetings. You know, what is the challenge that you're working on at the moment that is keeping you up at night, so that I can help them find ways to manage that? Mm. I'm loving it. I love being a mentor.
It brings a structure to the whole proceedings, I would imagine.
And I find after the year that actually we're ready to move on. The mentee, obviously we stay in touch and I'm always there if they've got any issue. But they're hopefully, if I've succeeded, by the end of that year, they've got the tools to go forward in what they'd originally wanted to achieve. And then I can move on to someone else and hopefully add value to them.
Precisely. It's a case of recognising where's the person achieved what they wanted to achieve, mm-hmm. and how can you help more people, but at the same time keeping very strict, so which allows you to apply enough attention to those people, I would
imagine.
Exactly. And so thank you so much. To begin to close our wonderful conversation.
I'd
like to ask you the question that we ask all guests. What's your dream holiday destination? Go.
Okay. Is it with my kids or without my kids?
Let's say one with, one without.
Okay. With my
keep the kids in a lovely, lovely place while you go off.
Okay.
Else.
So without my kids, I would probably I'd probably go back to Japan. So I'm.
So
for our honeymoon, we went to Japan, and I'm very into martial arts. I don't train as much now, but I, growing up, I trained a lot in karate.
To what degree?
I'm a black belt karate. I'm a
black belt karate.
I'm a third dan in karate. And so for our honeymoon, the idea was for me to go and train with the senseis in Japan. And but we took our honeymoon 6 months after we got married, and I was quite heavily pregnant by then. So there was
not the best condition to do karate training.
And we'd been planning to jump out of planes and do all this exciting stuff. And anyway, it became much more sort of temple visiting and
still absolutely lovely.
It was lovely, it wasn't. So I would probably go back with Anthony, with my husband, to Japan. And then with my kids, we love South Africa, so it would probably be safari with them, seeing the animals and just experiencing.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much for being here.
My absolute pleasure. I've really,
really lovely to have you on as a guest for LGM Talks. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks to our wonderful producers and production team. We'll be profiling more employees from across the business in the coming months. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave the podcast a rating and subscribe to LGM Talks or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal and General Investment Management. Legal and General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website, And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.